There would be no sleep for me that night. Just thoughts racing through my head like someone had fired a bullet into a tin can. That blue truck, that mountaintop, all the blue trucks, all mountaintops, gone, vanished like ether in a vacuum of fear. I was incredibly happy for her. As for me, I was just grateful to have made it one more day. When you're at the bottom, the days are long. I didn't need an Oscar. I just needed one more day. Interlude. Holes. Addiction is like the Joker. It just wants to see the whole world burn. Chapter 6. Bruce Willis. After 3 long months of rehab, I was feeling better. Back on my feet, I was very excited to live a life that was not completely ruled by alcoholism and addiction. I had stopped drinking and drugging, and my cravings for each had disappeared. Something way, way bigger than me was in charge now. Miracles do happen. The first move I made was driving to Jamie Tarsus's house. "I need to process being sober," I said to her, "and that's going to take up all my time. I'm incredibly grateful for all the wonderful things you did for me." I could see her face losing color. "But I can't be in a relationship right now," I said. So, to be clear, in order to adequately pay sweet, wonderful Jamie back for 2 years of giving up huge portions of her own very busy, important life by basically being my nurse, I ended our relationship. Jamie Tarsus was one of the most magical, beautiful, smart, oh, so smart. I love the way her mind worked. And I broke up with her, proving that getting sober didn't make me any smarter. In fact, it may have made me a colossal idiot. Jamie was probably the most amazing person I had ever met, and she loved me. But I wasn't ready for that. What I said to Jamie that day was all bullshit, of course. I was newly sober, a huge star, and I wanted to sleep with every single girl in Southern California. And I did. Insert cartoon anvil landing on my head here. Because of this huge star thing, I had no problem getting dates, and this is how I opened each and every one of them. "Hi. Sorry I'm late. You look great, by the way. I've been really excited to finally meet you." Pause for appropriate positive response. "But I don't want to get off on the wrong foot here," I would continue. "I want to be as transparent as possible. I'm an open book. Ask me anything. I'll tell you the truth." More warmth would be shared. On a good day, she would tend to be nodding along, loving my transparency, my emotional pitch, my very air of suave involvement. Then I'd bring the hammer down. "I'm not sure what you're looking for, but if it's any kind of emotional attachment, I'm not your man." Pause to let this sink in. "I'm not going to call you every day," I went on. "And I'm not going to be your boyfriend, but if it's fun you're looking for, I am your man." That great 20th century philosopher Cyndi Lauper was right, as it turned out. Girls do, in fact, just want to have fun. But in case the message wasn't entirely clear, I added some salt to the heady stew I was ladling out. "I'm an extremely passionate person," I said a little abashedly, in case they thought I protest too much. "In fact, I'm a bit of a romantic. Even beating up the elliptical machine, all I do is listen to songs about women in some kind of duress. But I'm not looking for or available for any kind of emotional relationship." I repeated, just in case the message had been a tad fuzzy. "I just got out of a long-term relationship, and I had just gotten sober, and I'm not looking to be in one now." And then it was time to nail the landing. "Oh, did you want to look at the menu?" I'd say. "I hear the food here is fantastic." It is amazing how many women signed up for this after all that. I presume many of them thought they could change me. "What's that you say?" Oh yes, I did get the occasional abrupt walkout, of course. A few women would say, well, I'm not interested in that at all, and would just get up and leave. No surprise that those were the ones that I was really interested in. But for the most part, my speech worked to a T. I use the word worked loosely, because I barely need to point out that the best you could say about all of this was that at any point you could exchange my head for a donkey's ass and no one would see the difference. Not only had I just broken up with the greatest woman on the planet, what I was proposing was just a fucking waste of time. Sex is great and everything, but I think I would be a much more fulfilled person now if I had spent those years looking for something more. In a life riddled with mistakes, this may have been my biggest one, and mistakes are hard to undo. During that time, I met at least 5 women that I could have married and had children with. Had I done so just once, I would not now be sitting in a huge house overlooking the ocean with no one to share it with, save a sober companion, a nurse, and a gardener twice a week. A gardener I would often run outside and give $100 to so he'd turn his fucking leaf blower off. We can put a man on the moon, but we can't invent a silent one of those things? Natasha Wagner was one of these women. Not only is she beautiful, smart, caring, and sexy, she's also the daughter of Natalie Wood and Richard Gregson, and raised by Robert Wagner and then by Robert Wagner and Jill St. John after her mother's tragic death. Natasha had it all. She was perfect. But I wasn't looking for perfect. I was looking for more, 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 more. So, because I'd done the speech at her and then not properly dated her, we parted ways. And I was left to find even more perfect women when, in fact, I'd already found them. A few years later, I was driving on the Pacific Coast Highway one day in some kind of fuck-off-everybody car, a car so amazing that I now cannot for the life of me remember what it was. I had the top down, the glistening sun was picking the edges off the surf out in the ocean and turning it into a slippery silver. Dudes on surfboards lounged around waiting for the one, which never came. I knew exactly how they felt. Then, my phone rang. It was Natasha. She had fallen for me after one of these dates, so she had to go. That's the rule, Maddie. That's the rule. But somehow, even though I jettisoned her, she was still a friend. "Hey, Maddie," she said in her inimitably sunny way. She was as bright as the sun on the ocean, always. Sometimes I had to look away just to get my bearings back. "Hey, Natasha, how are you?" I said. It was so lovely to hear from her. "What's going on with you?" Perhaps if she was calling me, there was a chance that we could... "I'm a mother," she announced. "I just had a baby girl, Clover." "Oh," I said, then quickly recovered, or thought I did. "That's fantastic news, babe. I love that name, too." We talked for a little while, and then we got off the phone. And then, out of nowhere, the fuck you everybody car was pulling over. Because I was pulling it over. And I lurched to a stop on the verge. The sun was still high. The surfers were up on their boards. But I was utterly thunderstruck with emotion. This giant wave everyone was looking for was happening in my head. "She could have had that child with me," I said to no one, as I sobbed like a newborn myself. I was so sad and alone. I cried for about 45 minutes until, gradually, a new thought came, like clouds across the sky above an ocean. Jesus, this is quite a reaction. It behooved me to work out why I'd broken down so hard. I sat there, wondering and wondering, until I finally realized what the fuck I had been doing. I'd been looking for an hour or so of pleasure with every woman ever invented, when there was so much life I was missing. Is this why I got sober? To sleep with women? Surely God had something better in store for me than that. I would need to find out, and fast. Natasha's life was blossoming while mine was turning into one huge mistake. When I try to work out how sobriety and addiction work for me, I keep coming back to this line. I'm capable of staying sober unless anything happens. Some quiet days, when I was sober, I'd think back to the recent past and wonder why I'd ever picked up pills or drugs after getting clean. When I was sober, strong, and feeling like a normal person, I'd sometimes have a fantasy of putting on a baseball cap and shades and heading off to mingle with the regular people poking around the La Brea tar pits. Or standing next to some celebrity star on the Walk of Fame, just to see what it's like. Not in the sense of, I'm a star, I'm better than them, no. In the sense of, oh, this is what a sober life feels like. But I was still so often just a tourist in sobriety. It was so hard to put down roots in it. Why was it so hard for me when I'd seen hundreds around me do it with impunity? I was dating literally everyone and anyone in LA, but I'd also met a woman in New York I really liked. I was not faithful to her, but I loved her. I was newly sober and famous, and I wanted to fuck everybody in Los Angeles County. Many reciprocated my desires. My speech worked far more than it had the right to, but the woman I loved in New York was like a good mom. A great caretaker, so beautiful. So, of course, I was drawn to her. And, of course, I screwed it up. But it wasn't all bad. In LA, I was also working to help other alcoholics get sober, sponsoring people, answering calls whenever needed, imparting advice. Friends was a juggernaut, too, and I didn't have to worry about fucking that up. I was clean, and I was about to have my season. The one where everyone was talking about Chandler. 9 was the only year I was completely sober for a Friends season. Care to hazard a guess as to which was the one year I got nominated for an Emmy for Best Actor in a Comedy? Yep, season 9. If that doesn't tell you something, nothing will. What did I do so differently that season? I listened. I didn't just stand there and wait for my turn to speak. Sometimes in acting, it's more powerful to listen than to talk. I've tried to incorporate that in my real life, too. No more, say less. That's my new mantra. The 2 years flew by. Maybe this is what normal people feel. Maybe I'd found my calling. Beyond friends, beyond movie stardom, beyond everything, I was here to help people get and stay sober. And then something happened, and I'm capable of staying sober unless anything happens. One of the women I'd used the speech on had grown attached to me, and as we know, dear listener, if that happens, I have to backpedal. So that's what I did. I said, I don't love you. I warned you when I met you. Remember the speech when I asked you about the menu? But it was too late. Some kind of agony hook was in her. It was my fault. Is this why I got sober? To sleep with women and then to hurt them? Surely God had something better in store for me than that. She was staying at the Beverly Hills Hotel at the time, and I went to see her, but she could not be consoled. She reminded me of my mother. No matter how much charm I used, no matter which funny thing I said, I could not help her pain. Eventually, she stormed off into the bathroom, leaving me alone in the room. On the side table, there was a knocked-over bottle of Vicodin. 3 of the pills had spilled out under the glare of the bedside lamp. She was locked in the bathroom, screaming. I couldn't take care of the situation. This was the anything that was happening. So, I took 3 of the pills, and somehow made it through the night. But I had thereby ended 2 years of sobriety. I was in deep, deep shit again, because once you puncture the membrane of sobriety, the phenomenon of craving kicks in, and you're off to the races one more time. It was impossible for me to get back. I graduated quickly to getting my own pills, and then I was drinking again. I was knowingly surfing down a long slide to oblivion. But it was bigger than me. There was literally nothing I could do about it. Looking back, all I would have had to do was tell someone about it. But that would mean I would have to stop. But stopping was not an option. At one point in 1999, I was sitting alone in my way-too-big house at the top of Carla Ridge, yet another house with a beautiful view, this time of the Los Angeles Basin. Down there, somewhere, normal Los Angeles life was going on. Tar pits, Walk of Fame. Up here, I was just waiting it out, drink in one hand, steady flow of Marlboro Lights in the other. We were five seasons into Friends. Ross and Rachel had just stumbled out of a chapel, married, ahead of Chandler and Monica. Friends was a cultural touchstone, a shorthand for the millennium, the number one show on the planet, everyone's favorite watch. And that way of speaking, could this be any hotter, had swept the nation. Now everyone was talking that way. Clinton was in the White House. The date September 11th meant nothing special unless it was your birthday or your wedding anniversary. All the water in the world was flowing downhill into a sparkling lake upon which the most beautiful, nameless birds endlessly floated. Now, a messenger was at my door, interrupting my reverie. It was as if I was reenacting what had happened to the romantic poet Coleridge, who had been interrupted from his own buzz. He got his via opium, by the legendary person from Porlock. At the time, Coleridge had the entirety of his poem Kubla Khan memorized in his opiate-addled mind. But the messenger who had arrived at his door that day in 1797 had shattered that memory, leaving only 54 lines for posterity. I was no Coleridge, but my buzz had been notable all the same. The view and the vodka tonic and the sweet Marlboro burn had rendered me into a safe place, where I was no longer unaccompanied, where somehow, back there in the house behind me, a beautiful wife, a gaggle of amazing kids were tumbling around in a playroom while Daddy had some quality time alone in the screening room. You want to feel lonely? Watch a movie alone in the screening room. It was at times like these, when the haze was deepest, that I could imagine my life was not filled with holes, that the minefield that was my past had been metal detected by men in hazard suits into a benign and beautiful safety. But now, my doorbell was buzzing, killing my buzz, and because there was no wife, no kids, it was up to me to reluctantly answer it. The person from Porlock handed me a package, inside of which was a script entitled The Whole Nine Yards, and my manager had written on it, could be pay dirt. It was no Kubla Khan, but I could see it was going to be huge. I was always bad at reading scripts. Back then, I'd be offered millions of dollars to do movies and barely crack the first few pages. I'm embarrassed to admit that now, given that these days, I'm writing scripts myself, and it's like pulling teeth to get actors to respond. Maybe they feel how I used to feel, that in a life of fun and fame and money, reading a script, no matter the size of the number attached, feels all too much like school. The universe will teach you, though. All those years I was too this, too that, to read a script. But last year I wrote a screenplay for myself and was trying to get it made until I realized that I was too old to play the part. Most 53-year-olds had worked their own shit out already, so I needed to hire a 30-year-old. The one I chose took weeks and weeks to respond. I couldn't believe how rude his behavior was. "Do I still have enough juice to get an independent movie made?" I asked my manager, Doug, in frustration. "Not really," Doug said. But back then, in 1999, my person from Porlock had brought me a script that even I could see had potential. And that potential was that none other than Bruce Willis was attached. At the turn of the century, there was no bigger movie star than Bruce Willis. He'd already banked Look Who's Talking and its sequel, the Die Hard franchise, Pulp Fiction. There was no one more successful back then. Not to mention that it would be a welcome relief from the 72 romantic comedies I'd just completed. Mitchell Kapner had written a funny script filled with twists and turns, and it was easy to read, always a good sign. Best of all, Bruce Willis was in it, and I played the lead character. Show me an acclaimed and successful TV star, and I will show you a frustrated wannabe movie star. Pay dirt?